You know, Jeff Merrick, it's one of those weeks, my friend. It's one of those long-ass weeks. It's already Wednesday. It feels like it should be Friday at 5 o'clock. It's one of those weeks where you, well, you see things you wish you didn't see.
Well, yeah, like what?
It affects you on a personal level. Well, I mean, like the thing we're all talking about this week, which is, of course, the appearance of pumpkin ale from Southern Tier in abundance at Wegmans. I couldn't
showed
believe
up,
it.
Eh?
A pumpkin ale available in August, for one thing, is blasphemy. And secondly, what's happened to this great brand, a brand of beer that we've talked about before on this show, what I believe is the epitome of pumpkin beer, even after you gave me that delicious pumpkin beer at your party a couple
great
years
Lakes.
Back.
That's right, Great Lakes.
What happened is now it's available in abundance. Now there are stacks on stacks of pumpkin ale at the Wegmans and other places. And I'm saying to myself, this is horseshit. Like,
why?
This was the beer that you had to go to the beer store the day they got the delivery to ensure that you got the bottle, or else it was going to be gone by that afternoon. And now the garage band has signed a record contract. Now they're playing stadiums, and I don't like it one bit. It happened to me with a wine, too. I'm a huge fan of a winery called Michael David out of Lodi, California. Yeah. And they do a wine called Seven Deadly Zins, which is a very clever name. And
it's a good name for a Zinfandel.
It's, and in fact, it is. And I love this wine, and I love it very, very intensely. But what's happened over time is that they've mass-produced it. Now, it doesn't mean that the quality is diminished at all, and I'm sure it's the same thing with pumpkin ale, that the quality will not have diminished. But it's just not as special. It's what I've always argued about the NHL in the U.S. Like, I know everybody wants the NHL to be hovering above the NBA in popularity and on par with the NFL, and that'd be great and whatever. But I've always loved the idea, and I'm sure that I think soccer fans are probably going through the same thing right now. I always loved the idea of it kind of being a little bit of punk rock for us. Like, American hockey fans know each other. We speak the same language. We don't have idiots like Skip Bayless spewing bile all over our players all the time on ESPN. Like, we're able to exist in our own little happy bubble. And right now, the bubble is clearly expanded. It's a very large bubble. It's one of those novelty bubble makers that those people have at the park that they make for kids. And then you have to give them a dollar because they made a friggin' soap bubble for your child.
Okay, hold on. Hold on.
It's one of those
here.
Bubbles, but we're still kind of separate from everything else. We've not reached the stacks on stacks of pumpkin ale at the Wegmans yet. We're still our own thing. And that's one of the reasons I like hockey, by the way.
Okay, a quick straw poll here of everyone listening to MVSW right now. Quick show of hands. Who's going to stop smoking weed when it's available at Wegmans? Quick show of hands, anybody? Oh, yeah, exactly.
Well,
nobody.
Listen, the real test, my friend, is when they make weed available at Costco and Sam's Club, when you can buy the weed in a giant brick and bring it home.
That's right, Paul. What's the wheelbarrow for? Huh? Yeah.
Like, I don't have any
Having
need.
A hard time sleeping.
I have no need for 51 rolls of paper towels. I don't have any need for it. I don't even use 51 rolls of paper towels in a decade. But a brick of weed at Costco, I think I might need that.
The time
and also
is
the
coming,
greatest thing,
sir.
The greatest thing ever is if they, and I know you guys have Costco up there because remember I went to a
of
Costco.
Of course, yeah. There's Costco here.
It's where there's actually one right next to the arena in Vancouver because remember I was getting food there before and after games during the Olympics. The greatest thing about Costco, of course, is that if you are imbibing the brick of weed when weed does become available at Costco, you are in a Costco. If there is that wonderful after effect in which you may be hungry for a morsel or two, not only do they have giant R2-D2 sized containers of cashew nuts, but they also have like hot dogs and sausages for like 50 cents at the commissary. It's really the best place ever to be high, I think.
IKEA would be pretty cool too, because you get really distracted with some fun stuff to put together. And if you like hot dogs, I think they have like the 50 cent hot dogs. You're like, yeah, the cheapest meal on checkout. So if you're getting high, don't worry about Costco. Do it at IKEA. That's the place to go.
Patrick M. writes in, just wait, it's coming to Washington State, home of Costco and legal weed sales. Could you imagine?
Yes.
I say, could you imagine?
Hey, you see, that's the difference between you and me, because I've grown up where hockey is very mainstream, and hockey is like football here, and hockey is everywhere, and it doesn't have a punk rock element about it. Like, I've never felt I've never had that feeling. I do understand the feeling like when your favorite, you know, indie rock band signs with a big label and goes, you know, boffo popular. They're not your secret handshake band anymore. No. You know, yeah. It's not like the cool band that only you know about. So I've never felt that way with hockey. So that's as you described that wish, that's a unique feeling to me. I've never been in that headspace for hockey.
I know that there's always been sort of a disconnect when it comes to like me or any American writer writing about like acceptance for hockey. And mainstream people shitting all over it and whatever, and even like TV coverage for hockey, like, you know, we rail against the local news burying hockey as the last story of the broadcast, and it's like the last 10 seconds of the sportscast. And in Canada, it's the newscast. It's like the first story on the news is the hockey, not even like the sports.
No.
And so that's always been this weird disconnect, and I don't think I've ever bridged the gap with some of my Canadian readers as far as like understanding the hardships at times of the American hockey fan and trying to fight for their sport. But at the same time, there's been a disconnect, I think, with some Canadian readers in the sense that like we are our own little niche and we do have our own little secret handshakes as hockey fans. And it's not the national language of American sports is the National Football League. No question about that. But hockey has its place and hockey has its fans and hockey
exists
and it's the bestest thing because it's not the NFL and it's not overexposed and it's not this gigantic thing where people start, applying all of the societal norms on this thing because it's supposed to be more than just a game. I guess hockey gets some of that, but not as much as NFL.
Let me ask you a question as we get into deeper water on hockey and, you know, punk rock and secret handshakes and this is ours, it's not yours. Do you think the analytics crowd is going to feel that now that analytics has gone mainstream and, you know, companies like the one that I work for is going to start blending it more into their broadcasts? That it'll feel like their child has left the home?
We touched on this briefly before, but it's obviously more relevant now because teams are dabbling in a pretty big way. We'll get to the Leafs, obviously, on this podcast and the big hires that they've made and also the murdering of one of our favorite websites because of those hirings. But you're right. I remember in our previous conversation, and I still feel this way even now, about the analytics blowing up the way they are. I don't think it's going to be a case where they feel bad about it becoming so accepted, because I think there's a good portion of the analytics crowd that are that want that to happen because they want accuracy, they want better information, they want better analysis from people. Mm-hmm. There's going to be another segment they're going to be upset that they can no longer use that as a check and balance on people that are just non-believers because the non-believers are going the way of the pterodactyl. Mm-hmm. Assuming the pterodactyls are extinct, by the way, I've not been to most places in deepest darkest Africa to.
Hot take.
Thank you. But the other thing about it is I always thought that the reaction to the mainstreaming of hockey analytics was going to be the criticism shifts from you're not using this to you're not using this correctly. Like I always thought that'd
that's
be the next evolution.
Step. Yes. Yeah. That's going to happen. Yeah. That I can see that happening. And that's fine, and that becomes part of the conversation. But the way I look at it in a lot of ways is the same way the Canadians look at hockey. And yes, I'm using a wide brush to paint here, but I'm a Canadian, so damn it, I'm going to do it. Canadians can't understand how the rest of the world doesn't appreciate hockey. It's the best game in the world. Damn it, it's our game. It's an export. We're sending it all over the world. Don't you dummies understand how great this game is? But then as other countries and other cultures and maybe our neighbors, right beneath us, for example, you know, have the nerve to not only embrace the game, but at various times do better than us at the game, have the nerve to beat us at the game, develop players in a more expedient way, grow the game quicker than Canadians do. Canadians get their backs up and they don't like it. Like they want Canadians want the rest of the world to really enjoy hockey. Up until a certain point, and that point is the point right before you get good enough to beat us. At that point, Canadians want the entire rest of the world not to appreciate hockey anymore.
See, but there is a common thread here between American and Canadian fans when it comes to hockey is that American fans, and again, I will generalize here, by no means do I believe I speak for all American fans, I think we all feel the same way that you guys do, which is that we don't understand why people don't like hockey. We inherently don't understand why people don't like hockey. Like, hockey's the greatest sport by far. It has no equal. And we love it, and we go to the arena, and it's our temple, and all of it. And there is that feeling when you're talking to somebody, and they're just like, I don't know, hockey just doesn't do it for me. You're just like, but why? That's like saying oxygen doesn't do it for you. Don't you need it to live?
you know, it's so bland and flavorless. I could really use something else instead of oxygen.
Yeah, right.
Let me get like a tangerine tint to oxygen. So boring.
So we do have that feeling, but you guys feel it on a global level, and we feel right. it on a very local level, you know, as far as
that.
Like that sort of thing. But anyways, the analytics thing obviously is front of mind this week because of the hirings that the Toronto Maple Leafs have made. On the heels of Tyler Dello being hired by the Edmonton Oilers, the Toronto Maple Leafs hire Daryl Metcalf, who is the creator of Extra Skater. And
good scoop. Hang on. I guess. Good scoop by you, Ice Cream, by the way. That was yours.
Oh, that was mine. Broke that news.
Mr. Scoopage. I know. You
got props from Damian Cox for that. So please make sure bring your umbrella when it starts raining dogs and cats.
When news breaks, you fix it. I've always said that about you, Greg Wyshynski.
That's right. Exactly. So Cam Sharon, who's a friend of the blog, gets hired by the Leafs as well. The Metcalf thing's the real interesting one, obviously, because not only did the Leafs acquire a guy who is top of the line as far as his analysis of analytics and things of that nature, but they get the whole shebang. They get
here's the thing about the whole shebang. Yep, but the thing is, and I don't want to just say that he wasn't an innovator because he was, with his blog, and it was a very influential blog, certainly, and a great resource for people like you and me and everyone listening to this podcast. But all the elements of that blog are available elsewhere. Like, he did a great job of pulling all that information together, making it very readable, very digestible, easily to understand for people. But it wasn't as if, it wasn't as if he was Neil Armstrong here, right? That's not virgin territory. Like that information is still out there, and it's still available for everyone. What he did, and again, it's not just he just popularized what was out there and pulled it together in a digestible form. But what he did was he made it a very accessible website to be part of, and a very accessible website to read.
Right, and he was not even, he was up there as far as the more, the site was up there as far as the go-to places for analytics, but I don't even think that he is in the same school as Dello and as Eric Tolsky, for example, as guys that have, been able to crunch the numbers and come to really enlightening conclusions about players.
For me, I'm a Dello guy. I'm a Paul Heyman guy. I'm a Dello guy when it comes to that, because I would read Dello's. I would read Dello's blog,
I missed it too. Yeah.
But the thing about Dello's blog is, the numbers are the numbers, and from a story point of view, it's not that compelling to look at a bunch of numbers. But what Dello would do is go, okay, here are the numbers, and here's what it means. And he would almost sort of walk you through a narrative of what these numbers are telling us. Now, of course, some of it is blended in with interpretation, and that's just a matter of his perspective. But to me, Dello's blog was the great loss. Like, as much as everyone's saying, extraskater.com is down, to me, the bigger loss is MC79 Hockey. And all the really great, that site was brilliant. Like, I know that that's, sensitive information to have out there, and he works for the Oilers now, and as such, he probably shouldn't have that blog up there. I kind of get that, but man, I wish that he just would have been able to leave it. Just even if nothing else, and this is like the Hall of Fame guy in me, as a historical document of what led up to, as part of what led up to this movement of analytics. Because this is a very important chapter in the history of hockey right now. Like right now, this is a pretty interesting time for hockey, with the analytics movement starting to gain a stranglehold within the confines of a very old boys network. And for, if for no other reason, leave that website up there as a matter of public document as to how we got there. The fact that it's gone really bums me out from a historical point of view.
And also, he was a brilliant writer too. I agree with you on that one. But I think the bigger loss is Extra Skater, because it was a clearinghouse of amazing information. It was user friendly. A guy like me that sucks at
all math information available elsewhere. But it's all available.
It was still out there, though. But it was searchable.
Okay, that's fine.
Well, all due respect to Gabe Desjardins,
you can do that.
I used Behind the Net before Extra Skater came around. But Extra Skater came out, and I'm just like, my God, it's like going from stick shift to automatic. Like it was that kind of change for me.
Okay, but do you not think there's going to be another Extra Skater out there? I was reading, Russian Machine Never Breaks last night, and, you know, they're trying to fundraise for a project to start up another extra skater. There is a void in the marketplace. You know, nature abhors a vacuum, so does the internet. That will be filled. There will be another extra skater. It's too valuable a commodity not to be. Like, that's not dead and gone. But Tyler Dello's brain on MC79 Hockey, that has been shut down. That is exclusive domain now of the Oilers. You're not going to replicate that.
The interesting thing about the extra skater void is, yeah, I do think that a site will rise up and take its place. It has to. I mean, there's clearly a demand for it. But until it does, what the Leafs have done is taken that stuff off the table for teams that were using that site for that very purpose,
yeah,
which is to gain access to possession numbers and stuff, too. And don't discount that. Don't discount the idea that now all of that information is there. Well, let me rephrase that. The information is the NHL's. That's part of the issue with trying to, say, like, sell your site to a third party, is that essentially all of the stats on that site are intellectual property of the National Hockey League in some way, shape, or form. That's why the NHL came out with that terms of service thing, because they can target you. Like, the stats are out there. It's hard to, if they took somebody to court about the stats, they'd lose, but they can make life difficult for you in trying to gain that information, because the information is essentially being harvested from NHL.com. So all that stuff's now the Leafs, and it keeps it away from other people. And it also gives them whatever software Daryl was using. Because the thing about Extra Skater that I think is puts it up head and shoulders above all the other sites was, I think they had a depth of stats and different metrics that I didn't see elsewhere. And and that's a credit to the software that he wrote and used and the information he was able to glean. So it's all pretty good. I want to mention, though, I mean, as much as we lament the loss of Extra Skater and talk about what to do, Scott Huntington, of course, mentions, as other people have mentioned to me in the last 24 hours, that if you go to web.archive.org and look around a little bit, you can still find all of the information on Extra Skater for the years gone by. Obviously, nothing new is going to be churned out for that site, but you can still find the clearinghouse of old information for stuff like that.
Well,
so
that's good.
Good times there.
That's good.
There you go. Trevor Connors writes because in behindthenet.com too? No, come on.
I saw that and I just checked and I just went to behindthenet.ca and there it is. It's still there.
Okay. Just checking.
Because now it's like, stats player. They've taken it up. It's freaking an Agatha Christie novel now. Which analytics site is going to be gobbled up next? So every day you go and see, it's like Murder on the Orient Express. Like every time the lights go out in the boxcar, someone dies or someone disappears.
One really valuable lesson from the last few weeks here that should be noted, and we should get to the intro because I know Chris Johnson's going to join us pretty soon to talk about the Leafs and all this other stuff. One really valuable lesson that I hope everybody's learned throughout the hiring of all of these stats guys and analytics guys to these teams, the lesson is this. You can actually write caustic, nasty, critical pieces about a team and do business with them later on. I think a lot of people out there think you got to kiss ass and give little foot massages to people if you want to get hired by them. But at the end of the day, it's about, for a lot of people, it's about the quality of the work. And the quality of the work Dello does is indisputable. The Leafs obviously think that Cam does great work too. Both of those guys were extraordinarily candid and honest about the teams doing terrible things and being critical of their approach and everything else. So sometimes if you are their toughest critic, you may be the first person they call when they need a change of direction. So lesson learned, ladies and gentlemen, you don't have to kiss ass in this industry to get ahead.
Not true for all teams, but I think commendable for the Oilers and commendable for the Maple Leafs. I mean,
and in the Leafs case, obviously.
That's more Shanahan and Dubas. That's Shanahan and Dubas. I don't think that David Nonis is rushing out to hire Cam anytime
soon.
There's
a changing of the guard there, yeah.
But listen, man, like, you know, Dello would, you know, rip Edmonton on the regular, and Dallas Aiken's point, I can't remember which, you know, he's talking to a radio station in Edmonton, said, well, yeah, he should have ripped us. We were 28th place. Like, there's a real maturity with Dallas Aikens. Like, he's not one of these guys that just, you know, lives in his little cone of what he believes in. Like, he will listen to things that are really harsh but really true if it can lead to more wins. Doesn't matter what the message is or who the messenger is. If he believes it will help the Oilers win, he's interested. And, you know, his antenna is up. So I think you got to give a lot of respect to Dallas Eakins out of all of this, who, like a lot of coaches, and that's this is his first shot at the NHL, all right? And someone is, you know, with razor blade preciseness, you know, pointing out where the Oilers are making their mistakes. Mm-hmm. That's a tough nut to swallow when you're a first-year NHL coach. Yeah. And to go out there and say, you know what? He was right. And you know what? I'd rather have him on my team than against it. And we're going to try to fix this thing together. Good for Dallas Eakins.
Absolutely.
I think that's, really it's fantastic for Dallas Eakins.
And here I thought his legacy would be simply putting broccoli in the press room. But lo and behold, it's making all this headway on analytics.
Concerned about, you know, the writers in Edmonton and things like diabetes and being overweight. So good for Dallas Eakins. He's looking out for everybody.
As everybody in the listening audience obviously is doing themselves right now, Jeff Merrick, it's pronounced diabetes, according to Wilfred Brimley. Chris Johnston will join us, and we'll also talk about the sale of the Islanders and the on-again, off-again, on-again, off-again, off-again, on-again, on-again, off-again of the Bertuzzi-Mora lawsuit, plus going post. Can we go do the intro first, or, you know, no? Okay.
Nah, I don't know. I'd rather just talk to Chris.
All right. Chris Johnston of Sportsnet joins us now, bumping our most important guest, the intro, for Chris Johnston of Sportsnet. What's up, Christopher? How are you?
I'm doing great, guys. Just at a iconic Canadian institution, Canadian Tire, doing some shopping here. Yep.
Very nice. Now, what is on the menu for you at Canadian Tire today? I was there a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, let me tell you, we're trying to get a few projects done before the hockey season starts, so I'm just buying some shelving units right now, and looking forward to the real hockey to start, so I don't have to do this stuff.
Okay, question. Let's see how Canadian you are. How many pairs of skates as a young man did you, or I guess your parents, buy at Canadian Tire?
Oh, I would say all of them, pretty much. You know, probably five or six anyway over the years, and I believe the last pair of skates that I have, it's still originally Canadian Tire. So growing up in a small Canadian town in particular, that's kind of a way of life.
You know, I have to admit my first time in Canada as a hockey writer and not as a child. Yeah, you know, my grandfather lived in Montreal for a really long time. But when I started coming to Canada doing this job and I would see Canadian Tire and then I would see somebody walking out of a Canadian Tire with like camping equipment, it made no sense to me. I thought it was like a Michelin. I thought you go there to get your oil changed, because that's what a tire place in the U.S. is. But lo and behold, it's like you buy all this other stuff there. I was very baffled by it, I have to admit.
Well, it's not just your hockey gear, too, or your camping equipment. You can get pretty much anything at one of these. I mean, it was kind of Walmart in Canada before Canada had Walmart. So.
It's for real, though, boys. In the U.S., if it has tire in the title, chances are you can't buy bakeware there. And so I don't even know what to say about Canada.
Okay.
Well, we all understand this stuff, though. We don't need it explained to us, Wish.
Okay. Hey, CJ, last thing on Canadian Tire, and I just tweeted this out saying, we're talking about this with Chris Johnston right now on the podcast. When I say Canadian Tire and I say Albert, what comes to your mind?
Ooh, you've stumped me.
Oh, you don't remember the famous Albert commercials about the kid that gets picked last?
No.
I'm pimping out my Twitter here, but I just tweeted out this, my favorite Canadian Tire commercial of all time. Kids on a pond, and this one kid, Albert, gets picked last, on the pond hockey game, but he ends up being the big superstar player years later. The one disconnect for me in this commercial, as I'm sure you'll see later on, you know, the kid goes and buys his equipment at Canadian Tire, and he turns into a great hockey player. I could never figure out why Albert had his first name on the back of his jersey, because as he turns to the camera to do the big celebration, as he's an adult and he's playing pro hockey for Canada, his name, Albert, is along the nameplate on the back. That is, if you're looking for a conceptual continuity and good psychology in this Canadian Tire commercial, you won't find it. But to me, this is the greatest Canadian Tire hockey commercial of all time. So go to my Twitter, at Jeff Merrick. I just tweeted that one out. CJ, I'm sure you've seen this one. I'm taking you back to the deep water of your youth.
It makes me so angry that you've not seen so many movies but can quote chapter and verse from a Canadian Tire commercial.
Yeah, that's right, from 1977 or 78 or something. Yeah, it's a great commercial. Albert. Everybody knows. Listen, anyone from my vintage knows exactly what the F I'm talking about. Don't worry.
Jeff, I just might be a little bit younger than you, that I might have missed that one. That's possible.
Wait, hang on. CJ, did we just have our first generation gap between us? Because usually you and I, when we sit down and talk in sports, like me and CJ are like right on point about tons of things. I think the Albert commercial may be our generation gap, bud.
Oh,
It could be. I mean, certainly if it was in the 70s, I wasn't around. So.
Oh, CJ, I thought you were one of mine. Oh, I thought you were on Team Merrick.
I'm close. I'm close. Just not quite there.
Close enough. Close enough. Hey, CJ, a couple of leafy things happened yesterday. Let's start with the Tim Leiwicki stuff. Is he gone? Is he going? Is he staying? Is he just staying until he decides he's going to be the one who says he's going? What's going on with Tim Leiwicki?
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear that he's not that long for the job. And you know, I'm not sure. I haven't actually had a chance to talk to my buddy Elliot Friedman about his report and get more of a sense of where he was coming from there. But, you know, these whispers have been around for a while. And it does seem that maybe Tim Leiwicki's time with the Leafs is limited. Although, you know, he's been pretty unequivocal in his denials and saying that he's around at least for one more year, you know, one more hockey season and basketball season for the Raptors. But, you know, I would think certainly by this time next year, you'll see him move on to something else. And, you know, I think really the job has worn on him a little bit, dealing with the board, with Rogers and Bell, you know, two enemies in every other way in business, except for in owning the conglomerate that is Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment has been tough for Tim. And, you know, I think he's looking at some other opportunities, but it doesn't sound like his you know, resignation or you know, any news that he's taking a new job is imminent, at least at this point.
You know, it's interesting as well when you look at the context of what this new collection of Maple Leafs ownership looks like. There were various challenges for a number of managers trying to stick handle, you know, the political waters when the Ontario Teachers Pension owned the Maple Leafs. Chris, could we say that it's even more difficult stick handle? Like there are more pylons on the ice right now with Bell and Rogers, as you mentioned. You know, not so much partners as much as, you know, feuding enemies. On the ice together, could it be even more difficult for someone to navigate now that it's not the Ontario Teachers Pension, but it's Rogers and Bell?
I think it's certainly become that way in the last year, you know, especially since, you know, Rogers stepped up and became the national rights holder in Canada for the NHL rights. You know, I think that, you know, obviously for those two companies, it was very damaging in terms of Bell. You know, they weren't happy with that. And in Rogers' case, you know, clearly something that changed everything for the company we work for, Jeff. So, you know, I think in particular since that's happened that maybe things have been difficult, but, you know, it does predate that as well. I mean, there's a lot of thought that when Brian Burke was fired just shortly after the lockout ended, that a lot of it was due to, you know, he didn't have the board support. And yeah. You know, I do think that is a legitimate issue for anyone working in the high ends of this company. And in a lot of ways, that the hiring of Tim Leiwicki was meant to kind of act as a buffer between the board and, you know, the likes of Brendan Shanahan or Dave Nonis on the hockey side. And it'll be very interesting if he does step away, you know, what that means for their futures and if there'll be someone else installed in that role or if those guys will end up having to talk right directly to the board when making moves.
28 minutes after the hour here on Leafs Lunch, Chris Johnston's joining us here on Sportsnet.
Flashback for Jeffy.
Yeah, I know. Where's Triple W, William Wayne Waters?
Moving over to the other news from the Leafs yesterday, of course, the analytics news. Let me ask you this, because I don't know if we've really talked much about this as a hockey community quite yet, but in the case of the Oilers and in the case of the Leafs, maybe not so much the Devils, but in the case of these two teams, I think there's a certain public relations aspect to diving into analytics. Here are two teams that are struggling. Here are fans clamoring and saying you're not doing enough to ensure your success and you're ignoring all these newfangled things that are making really good teams good. So they throw money at Dello and Edmonton. They throw money at Metcalf and Sharon and others in Toronto. And, of course, bring on Kyle Dubas. Is there a certain public relations aspect to this stuff, or is it strictly a hockey decision?
Oh, absolutely there is. You know, I think if nothing else, these organizations need to be seen as though they're doing everything they can to gain any advantage they can. And, you know, I don't think by any stretches it's solely public relations, but, you know, at some point, I mean, especially in some of the guys you mentioned there with Tyler Dello in Edmonton and Cam Chiron in particular among the Toronto hires, you've kind of taken out some of your more critical members of the public too. I mean, some of the more scathing stuff that was written about both of those teams came from those two gentlemen. And now I guess you've welcomed them in and you're going to try to use some of their ideas as well. But, you know, there is a PR boost, I think, from this, especially, you know, for younger fans and those that have maybe a bit more in tune to the analytics discussions, because, you know, it's two teams and two organizations that, you know, to this point have largely been tone deaf on that area and in that area. And now that appears to be changing.
You know, it seems as if right now, you know, the analytics ball is moving pretty quickly down the hill, and there's a real momentum to it. But around NHL circles, I'm curious around GMs specifically. I do wonder, CJ, how many general managers will hire someone to head up an analytics department? Maybe that department just consists of one person. So at the end of the year, that GM can put a check mark in a box when the president says, well, do we have anyone handling analytics? Oh, yes, we do. He or she's right over there in that office.
There's definitely some of that, you know, elsewhere. You know, what's kind of interesting, I guess, to me about the news that Greg Wyshynski had yesterday on the Leafs is that it suggests to me, really, that the Leafs aren't just doing that. I mean, it's pretty clear that Brendan Shanahan is very interested in this. You know, with Kyle Dubas becoming the Leafs assistant general manager, now, you know, essentially creating a department. I mean, I think this is a little bit more than just a check in the box. And, you know, it will take some time, I would assume, before there's any measurable or real way to see how this is working. But, you know, I think that this, to me, signals more than just, you know, kind of dipping your toe in the waters. I think that they're getting quite involved in this, and they're likely going to probably try to develop their own proprietary data, I would think, with bringing on Daryl Metcalf for ExtraSkater.com, now disappearing from the public domain, if you will. So, you know, I do think in some cases that's probably the case, but what's happening here with such a change to the Leafs front office, I think that this is a little bit more than just trying to appease everyone from the outside.
Moving over a little bit, Merrick and I were talking about this earlier, and I don't know the answer, but you're a pretty clued-in, tied-in guy, so let's ask you this. Why would the Islanders be sold to someone who's going to take control of them 2 years down the line? Do you have any idea?
I don't really. I have to be honest. I'm not sure what's been at play there. I mean, obviously that's been a tricky sale. You know, at one point, Charles Long was looking at selling to someone that he previously been in court with, so... You know, I think this has been a complicated process, but, you know, I don't know, and I haven't asked the right people exactly what is at work there with the transition that they seem to have put in place.
That's weird,
What does this mean for the future of the Islanders organization? I guess we'll have to, you know, see how the new ownership, once they fully take over in 2016, actually runs the team. But is there now reason for some optimism as the team transitions to Brooklyn?
I think there's a lot of room for optimism there in general. You know, I think they've had a decent offseason as it is. You know, I like, you know, them getting Yaroslav Halak. I mean, clearly goaltending was their biggest deficiency last year. I mean, this isn't going to cure all the ills in one fell swoop, but I do think they've made some pretty good hockey moves. And you know, the move to Brooklyn should, I would think, you know, have a positive effect on other players in the future wanting to play there. It's going to be more excitement, and it does get them out of that old barn Nassau Coliseum, which, you know, is kind of charming in many ways and, you know, harkens to a different era of the NHL, but clearly you can't have a serious franchise, I don't think, playing long-term in a building like that. So, you know, I do think that all this does bode well, but, you know, we're going to have to see, because this has sort of been a franchise that, since its heyday, has been run in a dubious manner, and you know, a lot will depend on what happens during that transition and how these new guys are going to run the team.
Yes, a bygone era where men were men and asbestos was in every lung. Chris Johnston, as we inch and eke our way closer to this season, sir, I wanted to get your thoughts on the teams that we're going to see in the season. Who is on your radar? Who are you most fascinated by entering the 2014-15 season? Who are you most fascinated by as far as teams that you cannot wait to see what they look like on the ice?
You know, the one that really jumps to mind is the Dallas Stars. You know, I think that's an organization, you know, we kind of have these truisms that we think about what a GM can do. And Jim Nill in 2 years has done what most people didn't think was possible in getting a couple top line centers or certainly a one and two. And he did that with getting the Jason Spezza deal done this summer and Tyler Seguin last summer. You know, to me, that is a pretty intriguing team to watch. And also, you know, the New York Rangers jump out to me. I mean, last year, you know, they wouldn't have been my hot pick. Obviously, I wasn't paying enough attention to the analytics to make it to the Stanley Cup final. And I'm wondering, you know, how they'll move on from that, you know, how they'll rebound from that. You know, it can be tough when expectations come on teams. I mean, in the East, that might be a team that I'm keeping my eye on. And of course, always the Toronto Maple Leafs, the team that plays closest to my front door. And whenever I turn on my radio, they're talking about them. And half the time it's me. And I'm curious, you know, where they'll go now with Randy Carlyle still in place. But everything else seemingly in the organization changed. You know, what we'll see different from them this year, or if it'll be more of the same.
You know, to wrap this up, and CJ, last question for me, to wrap this up in an analytics question again, it seems as if the battleground team this year is going to be Colorado, where once upon a time the battleground for analytics were the Toronto Maple Leafs. It seems as if analytically those cats and chicks have their eyeballs in Denver. Their PDO is too high. They're going to regress back. And what does that mean for the Avalanche? How do you see the Avs shaping up this season?
I think that there's a lot to that, to be honest. I mean, when you look, you know, at some of where they got their performance from last year, it seems to me that they actually had quite a lot in common with the Leafs, other than the terrible ending to their season late in the regular season, because they were a team that got outshot quite often, you know, that relied on very good goaltending, and it doesn't appear to be a model that can stand up. And, you know, I think certainly as well that we can't overlook, you know, them losing Paul Stastny in free agency to St. Louis. I think that's going to have an impact on that team, and I would tend to agree that will likely be the team that will be the toughest really to maintain where they were at. And in fact, you know, today I'm not sure that I would have them as a playoff team, although I haven't, you know, officially sat down and really looked at it and done my picks. But I could see them falling out, you know, despite the talent they have. It just seems to me that a lot is stacked up against them, and I do think it's going to be tough to repeat even the regular season they had last year.
Man, oh man. I kind of hope that's the case, not because I want to shit on the Avs. They all think I hate the Avs. I don't really hate the Avs at all. But because I feel like things went too well for Patrick Waugh last year. I think we didn't
too easy?
See. Yeah, we didn't get. We saw him shake the glass in game one for effect, but we didn't see crazy, intense 10-game losing streak. Varlamov gave up a softie with 5 seconds left, Patrick Waugh. And that's the guy I want to see. That's the guy I want to see.
Well, he was really Mr. Player's coach last year in the times I was around that team, and everyone was laid back. I mean, you're right. It wasn't really what we saw a lot of during his playing career and what we saw a hint of early in the year when he and Bruce Boudreau were getting at each other. And you're right. It'll be very interesting to see if things don't go as planned or hoped there, you know, how he responds to that, because I would think we will see a little bit more of that fiery temper he's known for, because you're right. He was Mr. Laid Back last year. I mean, it was really quite something to see. I wouldn't have expected that or called that. But something's going to set him off soon.
Wonder, yeah, if there is one of those 10-game skids, I wonder how tempting it'll be for Patrick to pull out these Stanley Cups in the ears line for the first reporter that asked him about the skid.
You know, I don't think it's pulling out that line. I think it's pulling out the spine of one of his defensemen, Mortal Kombat style, is what I'm looking forward to.
I think he's got the chance for some other lines, too. If I recall, in the playoffs, he made a gesture about putting your balls on the table or something. So I think that Patrick, you know, he might, I'm not sure if he's necessarily going to reach into his past, but he might have something else new that we end up talking about and remembering.
This time, but according to Chris Johnson, this time it'll be lottery balls on the table because he's not a believer in the Avs. Ladies and gentlemen. All right, Chris, thank you so much for joining us, sir, and we will talk to you soon.
No problem, guys, and I can't wait to see your Albert commercial there, Jeff. I hang up.
Yes, go. You know what? I know you're gonna. I know you're gonna. Oh, damn it! I know that commercial. So I'll expect a follow up text here in about 5 minutes, CJ.
Okay, sounds good, Merrick. Thanks, pal.
See you, bud.
It sounds like the Albert commercial is in the vein of the epic commercials that we have here in the States for, say, Taster's Choice, that follow one couple through a relationship, or maybe even the Budweiser commercials where a Clydesdale falls in love with a dog or a cat or another Clydesdale or whatever the hell they put on the Super Bowl, whatever the cute thing is that year, a hamster, crushes the hamster like Bambi meets Godzilla.
Go watch it. I think you'll love it. This is like a slight. I remember there are just some commercials you remember from your youth that will always be with you. For me, the Albert Canadian Tire commercial will always be with me. Like I could just, every now and then it'll pop into my brain. Jeez, man. Like it was funny because even just playing road hockey as a kid, when you divvy up teams, whoever was drafted last, we always called Albert. Mm-hmm. And whenever we get down to the last pick, everybody would start chanting, Albert. It was so cruel. Like if you're one of those like last three kids sitting there and everyone's chanting, oh man, you're a kid, right? So you're being really cruel. And then whoever was the last pick was always called Albert. Oh man, kids are ruthless. I was no different. I'm sure I was the same way. Just start chanting Albert at the kid. Then he has to wear it for the entire week until we play again.
I never pretended to be a jock, by the way. I'm not a jock. I'm not coordinated enough to be a jock. I was a good weekend warrior type athlete growing up, and I played a little baseball growing up, but by no means was I ever any good at any of this stuff. So what I was getting at is there is no greater fear for someone of limited skill than being picked last. I was never really picked last, but I was definitely let's just say that I was going to one of the playoff teams as far as the draft order.
Okay, you know, we've talked about this before on the show. You know, there's two kinds of dumb in the world. There's dumb and then there's hockey dumb. So, yeah. You know, the gym that I work at, Body Smith International, right? BSI. So it's full of like hockey players and a lot of the kids are going to camps in the next couple of weeks. So every day it's like someone different saying their goodbyes for the summer. So one of the kids today who's turning pro, he was having a conversation with a bunch of us today because he's got to change his number. Can't wear the same number in junior as he's going to wear in the pro ranks because someone's got the number. So you know what the conversation revolved around?
What's that?
What number can I pick that will make me look bigger? Like, can I put two numbers on my back that make me look bigger? And he kept coming back to 22. He thought the 2-2 made your back look bigger, sort of stretched it out, as opposed to just having like a single digit, like a 3 or a 4 or something like that. I think double nickels is a pretty good one to stretch out your back as well, to make you look bigger than you really are. But yes, that was the nature for about 20 minutes today. That was the nature of the conversation in the gym. What number can player X put on his back in pro to make him look bigger?
Right. 88.
Nope. That's a good one. Didn't work for Pat Kane, but it's a good one.
No, it doesn't work for Pat Kane.
We
got one more topic to cover before we get to going postal, and that, of course, is.
And I got a punt at 3. So
I know. Big things going. Merrick shooting TV promos, ladies and gentlemen, for the upcoming season of the NHL on Sportsnet. Only on Sportsnet.
Yeah, it's funny.
NHL.
That was good. That's right. We got it.
Okay. Let's talk about Kevin Hayes and Sonny Milano. First, Kevin Hayes. Right. Listen, I don't like to read too much into decisions. Kevin Hayes, free agent, rookie, signs with the New York Rangers. I don't like to, you know, just assume too much when it comes to these sorts of decisions. But I think we can say, without any doubt in our minds, Jeff Merrick, that Kevin Hayes, A, hates Boston, resented playing there, B, is convinced without a shadow of a doubt, that he made Johnny Gaudreau and not the other way around. Otherwise,
and
Ben Arnold. Otherwise, he's playing in Calgary. But clearly, Kevin Hayes, the Pippin to Johnny Hockey's Jordan, believes that he is going to go to New York and become a star and doesn't need Johnny Hockey. Yeah.
Right.
That's how I see it.
Or maybe he just says to himself, can I go to a competitive team that may have a spot for me? Because right now the Boston Bruins are kind of a full house. And as a matter of fact, they're in some salary cap, you know, uncomfortability right now. Maybe you look at the New York Rangers and you say to yourself, you know, if I'm Kevin Hayes, maybe I do have a shot at playing somewhere on this team.
Yeah, and same deal with the Blackhawks, obviously. That's why he left, was the idea that he was never going to get a chance to play there with the logjam in front of him. So there you go.
Could be.
I mean, I guess he assumes that the Rangers have a few more forwards to buy out in the next couple of years.
There's a couple of big question marks with the Rangers when it comes to guys that are sort of breaking into the lineup. Like, where does Jesper Fast go? Where does a guy like Oscar Lindberg go? Where does Chris Mueller fit in? There's some like real legitimate questions about what's happening up front. And then a lot of this is complicated with the fact that they went out and grabbed Matthew Lombardi. In the offseason, right? Like, where's the spot for Matthew Lombardi? So maybe Kevin Hayes looks at it and says, you know what? I can beat a guy like JT Miller for a spot. I can grab a spot there. I don't know. I'm really curious to see what went into the Kevin
especially
Hayes
when JT,
because I don't know.
Especially when JT Miller has been kind of yo-yoing back and forth between the AHL and the NHL anyway. So anyways, Sonny Milano, of course, was your scoop. I am not the only fully-fledged newsbreaker on this podcast. You, of course, had the Sonny Milano stuff way ahead of the curve. And what are your thoughts now that statements have been released and the Blue Jackets have discussed all of this stuff now?
Okay, so just so 2.5 weeks ago, I put the tweet out that Sonny Milano will decommit from BC and will play with the Plymouth Whalers of the OHL. Now, this is something that I heard going back to the day he was drafted, okay, in Philadelphia. I mean, this was you know, whispered and talked about. And then the story, anyway, behind the scenes from people in and around the Plymouth Whalers organization, people around the CHL, other people that I spoke to in and around Columbus, all were singing from the same hymn book, which is, yeah, it's just a matter of time before Sonny Milano tells BC that he's not going there and he's going to the Plymouth Whalers. Now, I put the tweet out. It was a Sunday. I'm like, you know what? OHL trade deadline freeze is coming up, so they're probably going to grab the kid from Sudbury, Matthew Campagna. He'll be the first line center. That'll open up the door for Sonny Milano to have his overage centerman to play with. It all makes sense. I'll put this out there now as just sort of grist for the mill and something to talk about. Sonny Milano was, of course, at U.S. camp at that point, and that's when all the comments came out about how the reports are inaccurate. People from the NHL picked up on the story, said, no, he's definitely going to B.C. Sonny Milano says he's going to Boston College. He's going to go play for York's program, and there's no way he's going to decommit. It's a bad story. Information is wrong. And I sat on it, and had a lot of people from college hockey Twitter send various daggers and bullets my way about I don't get my information right, I don't have my information on point, it's a bad report, you don't know what you're talking about, and I just sat on it. I said, you know what, let's just see what happens, because I called people after Milano said he's going to BC, and they're like, oh no, he's going to Plymouth, just a matter of time, he's not going to decommit at U.S. camp. He does not want to be pulled into a room and sat down and asked, what the hell are you doing? Are you decommitting? Are you going to go to Plymouth of the OHL and not go to Division One Hockey East? So when it happened, I can't say that I was surprised at all, because I was told this was the plan from day one. This was going to happen. I do want to point out two things. As much as I heard it on Twitter, and man, I got some nasty stuff on Twitter. I understand decommitting is a very sensitive issue, and it is a very uncomfortable one for Division I hockey. I get that. Like, and it happens every year, and I understand how it is a very touchy issue. So I understand where the hatred comes from. I understand where the anger comes from. But Wish, I got some nasty stuff. Two people specifically who stayed away from it. And no daggers, just took a sort of wait and see approach. One, our friend Nate Ewell, no comment, nothing. And Nate is, as we all know, the biggest, you know, he's like Mr. NCAA hockey. That's Nate Ewell. Not a thing. And the other guy was Chris Peters, who runs probably, well, it's my favorite anyhow, one of, if not the best NCAA hockey blog going. And his whole point was, let's just see what happens. There's conflicting stories. Let's just see what happens. Those two guys specifically were class of the entire thing. So when the news came out that Milano had told BC that he's not going, that he's going to the Plymouth Whalers of the OHL, I kind of went, okay. I didn't know that this was that big a news story. I almost thought that this was consensus around hockey, that this was just going to be the play. Mm-hmm. That he wasn't going to go to BC. That he was going to Plymouth. Now it's interesting the way that BC positioned the story, and I can understand why. Boston College said he has chosen to sign a contract with the Columbus Blue Jackets. They will dictate the course of his career. Politically, it's a lot easier to say that instead of saying he's turning down BC to play with the Plymouth Whalers of the OHL. It doesn't really sit well, specifically for an elite program like Boston College. But, I mean, had you heard anything different over the summer about Sonny Milano? Like, I thought that this was kind of consensus around hockey. This was going to be the play. But man, did people get nasty about it. Woohoo! Man, I got some nasty tweets. And exactly two people have apologized for them. Not that I'm begging for apologies because I don't expect it, but I was just like, man, if I did that to someone, I'd call back and say, you know what? My bad. My bad. I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah, apologies on Twitter. Well, I mean, if it's a proper Twitter apology, they'll just say that they were hacked. That's the only time anyone ever apologizes on Twitter. We got to do one more thing before we get to Going Postal, and we're running out of time for Going Postal, so we'll probably do some of it. We'll do some of it tomorrow. We're going to be back tomorrow, okay, by the way, as well to do the show. So we'll do some more Going Postal tomorrow. But we got to talk Bertuzzi more. Holy shit. So,
jeez.
Yeah, okay.
All right. So the news broke by Bob McKenzie yesterday that the two sides were close to a settlement before their September 8th civil trial was supposed to begin. Then Bertuzzi's lawyer said, "Oop, I just got a disturbing email, and I don't know if it's going to be settled." And then he came back 5 o'clock yesterday and said, "Huzzah, it's settled. Everything's cool." Except the Canucks didn't say anything, and neither did Steve Moore. Then today, Steve Moore's brother says to Rick Westhead of TSN, "You know, It's funny how everyone's writing about this thing being settled, except my brother says it's not settled. Also, we believe the Bertuzzi camp is trying to push things forward because we're convinced he's trying to do this to get it done so he can sign a free agent contract. So as of this podcast, the Steve Moore camp says that it's not settled. The Bertuzzi camp has said it is settled, and the Canucks have said nothing.
Oh, boy. Oh, man. It's funny because one of the promos I was shooting yesterday was with Dominic Moore. And so I spent the day with Dom yesterday, and when the information came out, I said, hey, here's the word. Looks like your brother and the Bertuzzi camp have come to an arrangement. And he was genuinely shocked. He's like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. I kind of, not that I expect him to betray, you know, family and state secrets, but he really seemed like genuinely surprised at the information. That's why when the news came in that perhaps there wasn't a deal, I kind of understood it, because, you know, here's Dom Moore saying, oh, wow, that's kind of a surprise. I mean, it's a good thing for both sides. Hopefully it gives closure to my brother, and Todd can move on with his career, and hockey won't have to be dragged through what will be the court case of the century in Canada.
Right.
But honestly, dude, if this one goes to court, it's going to be ugly.
Oh.
If this goes to court,
it's
ugly.
It's going to be hugely ugly, and imagine how ugly it's going to get for the, you know, with one network with a large reporting apparatus having no hockey on it hardly anymore. I mean, TSN, I guarantee you, would turn into the Bertuzzi Moore network. It would be like the OJ trial.
Yeah, I think, but the thing is, this one transcends just sports, though. I think, I mean, CBC News Network would pick it up. Everybody would pick this up. Everybody. This would be the story in Canada. Because this is, you know, opening up the guts of Canada's game. Mind you, it's opening the guts of Canada's game from 10 years ago, but still, it's opening up the guts of the game.
Yeah.
Like, everybody, news there, like, everybody goes with it.
It's an interesting case, because it would be interesting to see how Bertuzzi mounts a defense if he tries to pass the buck to Mark Crawford or others for what he did. And it would be an interesting case to see exactly how Bertuzzi's representatives argue what Moore deserves to get. Because you basically have to say that not only would this guy not have earned X amount of dollars as an NHL player, but despite being a Harvard graduate, he wouldn't have earned X dollars in the private sector. It becomes a very, very dirty, ugly, nasty, disparaging case. Yeah.
It's a real tricky one. And I am no legal authority by any stretch of the imagination.
Really?
Yeah, I know. I just play one on TV. And also at times during the lockout, I play as if I'm an actuary, as we found out during the last lockout. We all became experts on pensions somehow in hockey media.
Yeah, I think we always do pretty good shows. Like, I think they're all listenable. And I know a lot of people dive back into the archive to listen to stuff. Full marks to you if you dive back and listen to some of those lockout shows. As
oh,
me
God
and
bless
Eric
you.
Try to make heads and tails of this bullshit being sent our way, right?
Oh, yeah, good luck. You know, Jeez. From now on, now that we have more of a sort of cabal of listeners who have, you know, divergent interests and in various fields of expertise, next lockout, we're just bringing on listeners. Like, you know, Karen Douglas, Melissa Bergeson's an accountant as well. We're bringing on these people.
Yes.
To talk about the real issues. Greg and I will talk about, you know, changes to rules, or Greg and I will talk about maybe salary cap, maybe, I suppose. But I think for the next lockout, let's just have a team of listener experts that can come on and explain all these things. Because, man, me explaining pensions on this podcast was a joke. It was a real joke.
Also, we're going to hire a homeless guy to cover the meetings in New York. It's gonna
man
hire some homeless guy.
Yeah, well, if you want the man on the street, get a man who lives in the street. I always find that. We're going down to the man on the street. The man on the street's making $750,000 a year. Man on the street's a homeless guy.
In the remaining 5 minutes of the show, we will do the first part of a Wednesday favorite.
Are we even going to bother to do the intro?
Mailbag segment every week.
It's time to look deep into the souls of Jeff
Maddie.
Merrick and Greg Wyshynski.
Damn it, Maddie.
Whoa, not that deep.
We answer your mail.
PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com. On Twitter at Jeff Merrick and at Wyshynski. We're going postal on Merrick versus Wyshynski.
We're going to try to fit three in here.
All right.
Hockey porn. RT writes in... RT writes
in. It's already the weekend. Oh, good.
RT writes in, is a hot dog a sandwich?
I've heard this argument before.
Is a hot dog a sandwich?
It depends. No, to me, it depends on whether you consider the buns one bun or two pieces of bread joined together.
It's one bun.
Okay, is a grilled cheese sandwich a sandwich then? Because the two pieces of bread are technically joined together by the melted cheese.
That's stupid. The cheese is the filling. It's like a ham sandwich, except instead of ham, there's cheese there.
They join
it.
It's
one bun.
It's joined.
And here is my argument against the hot dog being a sandwich. When you have a bun like that stuffed with lobster or fried shrimp, it is called a lobster roll or a shrimp roll. So, if you have a problem and you need to identify what the delivery method of the hot dog is, it is not a hot dog sandwich. It is a hot dog roll. The hot dog is in the roll. Like,
what do you
like
call,
lobster,
okay.
like shrimp.
So we shouldn't call open-faced sandwiches open-faced sandwiches anymore because there's only one piece of bread then. It's no longer a sandwich. What is it then?
It is a sandwich, but it's open-faced. It's like, oh, Merrick, what is it? Is a car not a car if it's a convertible? It's the same principle.
I don't know. You seem to think that there has to be two separate and distinct pieces of bread.
I do.
For a sandwich to happen. So what's an open-faced sandwich? It's not
a
sandwich.
An open-faced sandwich is a sandwich that has, someone took a crowbar to it, pried off the outer layer, and exposed the innards
of the sandwich.
There
was never one to begin with.
Theoretically. Theoretically, that's the way it's made.
Okay, well then, okay, if you want to follow that logic, then theoretically, I never want to hear you say I took an elevator down. Because how do you elevate something downwards? I took an escalator down. Really? How'd you take it? Yeah, the descalator.
Can you tell me where the escalator is? It's over here, but what you're looking for is the decliner.
Exactly. Which I believe you want to go down to two? Yeah, you need the decliner, not the escalator. What?
Sean Hathaway. This might be the last one we get to, but this is a good one. Sean Hathaway writes in, hey, Jeff and Greg, I saw Guardians of the Galaxy last night and loved it. My roommate said it was one of the most fun times he's had at the movies in years. I was wondering, what's the most fun you've ever had at a hockey game? Maybe not the best quality game, but the most fun experience. P.S. Keep Game Show Friday. It's fun to play along at home, regardless of the contestants' performances. Sean in Boston.
And if he had written Turf Game Show Friday, would that have made it into the podcast?
Not at all. Of course not.
Okay.
People know how to get on the podcast. my answer...
And retweets from you, too, apparently.
People keep accusing me of this, and it's just not fair. I for some reason, everybody who comes...
Such a scam.
And gives
such
me
a fraud.
Gives me love, or reaches out to me, wants to keep game show. I don't know how it works.
Okay.
The answer for this one, I don't know if it's the finest game I've ever seen, but I do know it was the most fun I've had watching a game. And that would be May 4th, 2009, Crosby-Ovechkin dueling hat tricks.
Oh, yeah. Great game, fun time.
That was so much fun. Washington, D.C., Caps-Pens playoff series. Double hat tricks for Ovi and Crosby. Might be the best mano-a-mano individual performance I've ever seen as
that
well.
That was fantastic. Yeah,
and that was that's the most fun I've ever had at a rink. That game was such a great time.
Mine's a little, imagine that. Mine's a little more nostalgic than yours, Wish. I can remember one game specifically at Maple Leaf Gardens. It was an OHA, the forerunner of the OHL, junior hockey game between the Toronto Marlboros and the Sudbury Wolves, and my entire hockey team, props up, York Toros, all went. And what we did is in the hallway in the intermissions had this mini sticks hockey tournament.
No.
We'd watch the game, then the minute the period was over, ran into the hallway at Maple Leaf Gardens, like right where the stairs are, and took up one entire space and had a mini sticks tournament. That to me was the most fun I ever had at a hockey game. Hands down. That was the best one.
That's awesome.
Yeah, dude.
All right, we're going to do more Going Postal tomorrow because we kind of gave it a little bit of a short shift today.
Oh, so. Hang on.
Yeah?
Randy M., is a pizza just a huge open-faced sandwich? Greg?
No, it's not. Listen, Let's take a step back here and think about this, okay? There is a stuffed pizza. You can get it at Sbarro. It is arguably the greasiest thing you've ever put in your mouth. The pizza, at no point was there ever a thought to cover it. An open-faced sandwich, in theory, could either be a sandwich or not, or an open-faced sandwich. The construction of the sandwich still isn't with the idea that it could grow up to be a sandwich. We choose not to let it get there. We take the top off of it. That's how it is.
Take the elevator down, Wish. Take the elevator down.
Monica McAllister writes in another wrinkle to this debate, which is you don't usually eat an open-faced sandwich with your hands. Sandwich, hands, does it have to be something you can eat with your hands for it to be a sandwich?
You've never had a gourmet burger with a knife and fork?
Well, that just means you're a snot.
I wonder if the Earl of Sandwich actually used a knife and fork. By the way, Monica McAllister, by the way, tweeted in earlier, said she's never smoked weed. She might be the only one who's listening to this podcast right now.
She's never smoked weed. Doing it currently. What did you say, Maddie?
Maddie said the draft lottery regulations have been changed.
Oh, cool.
That's Christopher the Milk tomorrow. Okay.
Check that out right now.
Thanks, Maddie. Yeah.
There it is. All right, everybody. We will talk to you on tomorrow for more fun and excitement. And there it is. Thanks to Chris Johnston.
Sorry, Buffalo. Sorry, Buffalo. Just got harder to get Connor McDavid.
Why would they do? Real quick.
Draft lottery lods. Under former allocation 25. No, hang on a second. I got to read this here. I don't have time right now. Phase and odds would be adjusted to reflect increasing competitive balance in 2015. Lottery would be expanded to determine the first three selections in 2016. Okay. look at this.
The odds of getting the first overall selection in the NHL draft for the 14 non-playoff teams in 2015 will be adjusted to more appropriate.
Oh, man. Yeah, it just got harder. It just got harder for Buffalo and Winnipeg.
Yep.
More so from 25% to 20%. Oh, yeah. Oh, somewhere Tim Murray is whipping things against the wall right now. Sorry, Kevin Cheveldayoff. Sorry, Tim Murray. Tougher to get McDavid and Eichel.
But again, let's just point this out. If you are number 11 in the fewest points, if you have the 11th fewest points in the lottery, okay, or I'm sorry, in the NHL, your draft odds just doubled
from 1.5 to 3%.
Yes.
This is why the Flyers are getting McDavid. Come on.
It's entirely possible that the 11th fewest points in the NHL is a team that finished 5 points out of a playoff spot. Yep. And their draft odds just doubled to get Connor McDavid.
Wow, look at that, eh?
I am Team Tim Murray on this one, ladies and gentlemen. The idea that you're going to do this bullshit for this draft, come on. It's a joke.
Oh, wow. Buffalo better hope that the Islanders are really bad, too. Surrender that first-round pick.
Mr. Snyder, you've been nothing but good to me, so I've got a present for you.
Oh, jeez.
We're going to fix the draft lottery for you. Would you prefer a McDavid or an Eichel? An Eichel or a McDavid?
Let's pick this up tomorrow. I got to go to a meeting.
All right, you got to get out of here. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Bye.
I'm out of here.